Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome back to the Saleri Report, John Rapoport. As you know, one of my favorite sources for information, both on the faking of reality and reality. Every time I read one of his latest columns, and he's been covering events, including the school shootings, with great amusement and brilliance. Every time I read his pieces, I can draw on a huge body of work. I think I've read everything or almost everything he's ever written or spoken, or I've certainly tried. He has many things I can recommend to you, and at the end of this interview, we'll go through some of them with him. But he has years of great interviews with insiders. He's got a book called Secret Societies, which goes right to the issues we're going to be talking about today. He's also got a recording on the Age of Merlin, which is very long and one of my favorite things to listen to driving back and forth to California. I'd be embarrassed to admit to him how many times I've heard it. But he has an enormous body of work. We're going to be touching on it at the end of the interview. I'll go through how you access it, because you can find everything on his site. But I want to be talking about the school shootings, but also the way that false reality, official reality, is manufactured, because you're watching the manufacturing of official reality on steroids right now, which is unbelievable. And it causes great sort of sense of bizarreness and a feeling of Orwellianness for many of our subscribers. And so I thought this could really cut through the field and bring you back to a state of coherence. So, John, thank you so much for joining me on the Saleri Report. Welcome.
Great to be here, Catherine, as always, always.
It's always, one of my favorite quotes from the Buddha is, those who are awake live in a state of constant amazement. And the last couple of weeks, but it's been the last couple of years, really. We live in a state of constant amazement. Okay, so we had a school shooting, the Parkland school shooting. I know you've been covering it. Maybe you could just introduce to us the various options of what might have happened.
Okay. Well, like so many other school shootings, now that we have independent media, many contradictions and questions leak out, which in the old days never happened. A person at the school, a witness, I believe it was a teacher, who claims that she saw the shooter, Cruz, but he was wearing armor, police armor, that kind of armor. What is this? This has nothing to do with anybody else's account of what happened. We have reports from several witnesses, and I'm told that a couple of videos have been scrubbed out of YouTube that talk about multiple shooters, which is a recurring theme in many of these school shootings.
Right.
Of course, the police, the FBI, law enforcement has nothing to say about this, just as they had nothing to say about the Vegas shooting and many reports there of multiple shooters in different locations, including right. different hotels on the very night of the shooting.
Right.
So we have all these anomalies and contradictions. And then, of course, the question either always or often arises, is the shooter named by law enforcement the actual shooter, or is he a patsy of some kind who's been killed or arrested, in the wake of the shooting? Such information keeps leaking out to the point where, when we look at the corporate media account of what happened in this shooting and others, we get the flavor of spoiled food. This is the hashed over, spoiled
right.
meal that's been sitting around for days that is suddenly served up to the public as being authoritative. And more people are disbelieving what is being served to them on a platter. right. as the shootings keep on happening.
Right. Now, I went back and looked at the history of school shootings, and they started, believe it or not, in the colonial time. But you have really two patterns. One is, you know, one kid gets angry at a teacher and brings in a gun, and, you know, when one person shoots another. But then you have these spectacular school shootings where it's clearly a false flag. And some say in some instances it's just staged, you know, that nobody died. There was no real shooting. You know, it was just a staged event, which sounds bizarre when you hear it. But when you look at the price of engineering a false flag where 20 people die and the liabilities of dealing with their families, you know, at some point you can see why it would be easier to sort of organize and stage these things. So there's also that fact pattern. But if you look back, you know, the growth of the spectacular school shooting is a relatively recent phenomena. Really, you know, the 60s, it's basically the death of Kennedy on, or I should say the group that killed Kennedy got control of the machinery and, you know, they were off and running. And what you've seen is an acceleration of these spectacular school shootings. The one I think of as one of the most spectacular is one you wrote a great deal about, and that's Columbine, which was 1999. And so maybe talk a little bit about how you started to write about some of these things and then your work on Columbine.
Okay. Well, Columbine itself, I hope at least some people will remember, received the kind of wall-to-wall media attention that other shootings since then have, where all of the news coverage on all of the channels was live, with major anchors posted in the field at the scene, reporting to give the heightened sense of the drama and the tragedy and the horror and so forth. And one of the first things that I noticed, because I've been studying so-called psychology and psychiatry for a long time, is the aftermath, the immediate aftermath, which I think the phrase that I used was, here come the grief counselors over the hills. Because there was an invasion, a literal invasion, right. of Littleton, Colorado, at the scene, of grief counselors. And this was highly intentional, because the aftermath is very important to the people who stage these events as to how they're viewed. We must come together, the healing, the midnight vigils, the candles, and the grief counseling for the other students, for the parents, for the people of the community, to actually bring them into the system of therapy, psychology, et cetera, all of which is, well, it's two things. One is to bring them into that system, to make patients out of them, because we really are living more and more in a psychiatric police state where everybody's diagnosed with some kind of mental disorder. But the other thing is to deflect the emotions of people from anger, outrage, a demand to know the facts, paying attention to alternative scenarios of what happened during the shooting, to deflect all of that into, no, we must accept everything we're being told, and now we have to focus on this kind of new age healing that is going to take place, whereby we all, quote, become stronger and more interconnected and more unified and more whatever.
So let me say it this way.
Anything but outrage.
There's one way to heal from an experience like that, and that's to get to the bottom of what really happened. And then based on your knowledge of what really happened, make sure it can't happen again. That is the one way you can heal. And so the beauty of the grief counselors is they're trying to get you to stop focusing on what's going on around you, in reality around you, and focus on your own emotions and processing your own emotions. So instead of saying, what about the world? You say, what about me?
Right. What about me?
Right. It's a metaphor for what's going on and been going on for the, you know, ever since 1947, trying to get people to focus more and more on themselves and how they process their emotions and encouraging their emotions and turning them into babies.
You bet. Because there's no lack of feelings.
Right.
You know, you can, they're a dime a dozen. And they arise and they fall and they ebb and they flow all the time. But when you have the grief counselors and the therapists and the psychologists taking over, now they're saying, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about
right.
that? How do you feel about this? And suddenly that becomes the focus. A couple of other things about Columbine that I think are very important. One is, I spoke with a decidedly mainstream reporter from one of the, I think it was the Denver newspapers, because I had been tipped to him by somebody at the time who said he's got a different story. And we chatted on the phone, and he was very open. I said, what about the reports from witnesses that there were more than two shooters? Because that the story was two shooters, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold.
Right, two
kids. And
he
said, oh, yes. He said, oh, yes, more than two shooters. I said, really? He said, oh, yeah, we have reports on that. Well, no stories were coming out about it. Certainly nobody from these newspapers in the area were, you know, put on the case by their editors to actually delve into that. But here was this guy very, I mean, casually admitting, oh, sure, more than two shooters. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Wait a minute. That changes the entire scenario.
Right.
The scenario was these two kids somehow got together and formed some sort of grandiose trench coat mafia metaphor, plot, image to destroy the school and kill as many kids as possible. And that would have been ripped apart completely if we found out who the other shooters were and what that was all about. So that's one thing. The other thing was, and this is a whole subject we can go into, the psychiatric drugs and their tendency to push people over the edge into violence. Because I followed this very closely at the time. And at first, there was nothing about that in the press. And then a story leaked out that Eric Harris, one of the shooters, was on a drug called Luvox, an antidepressant, very similar to Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, that sort of thing. And in consulting with several psychiatrists, including Peter Bregan, a famous psychiatrist and author, he said, oh, yes, he said, these drugs can push people over the edge into making grandiose plans to destroy many people. No question about it. And that was my first clue that some of these school shootings, then, now, in between, you would trace back to that. Because people have to understand, there are many more school shootings that have occurred over the last 20 years than have been reported and sensationalized by the press.
Right, right.
You're only getting the big ones. There are many, many, many more. And there are links with these kids to taking psychiatric drugs, in particular the so-called SSRI antidepressants, which have been shown time and time again in reports and studies to provoke people into violence, suicide, homicide.
Kelly Amira did an analysis. She did a whole series of articles on this, and we've had her on the Salera Report because she ended up publishing a book. But as of 2004, every school shooting she looked at, the patsy or the child was on these drugs. Every one.
Absolutely. I mean,
right.
It's just staggering. I call it the Johnny Appleseed effect. You you plant or seed the society with so many diagnoses of, say, clinical depression, and you prescribe so many of these antidepressants that you are then going to see pop up here and there, now and then, unexplainable incidents of violence, suicide, homicide, etc.
Right.
And no other explanation is going to even get close to that, to figure out what in the world is going on. But that is, in fact, what's going on.
I had one cousin who was a teacher who retired, and one of the reasons she retired was she was being lobbied by so many parents to say that their child was ADHD or disabled so that they could then get Social Security disability, and basically, which was enough money to feed the kid. I mean, they were trying to get a check, but they had to diagnose their kid as such, which meant they would put their children on drugs. And basically, you know, if you look at how the system and the school system worked, parents were being paid to put their kids on drugs. And these were parents who were literally struggling to feed their kids. So this was a way to get the money they needed to feed the kid.
Absolutely.
Right.
I can also tell you that, and I've written about this, several years ago, a group of psychiatrists came forward and said, we are now prescribing drugs for ADHD to children in poverty-stricken inner-city neighborhoods, and we don't even have to make a diagnosis of ADHD, because this is our way of doing social justice and leveling the playing field to enable these kids to perform better in schools, perhaps approaching a level with the richer kids. These lunatic psychiatrists actually believe that the drugs for ADHD, which are basically speed, they're all amphetamine-like, and they all have the same effects as amphetamines do, would somehow up the school performance of these low-income kids and put them on a level with the more wealthy kids. This was their version of social justice, and it's still going on.
Right.
And to boot, I've also published figures stating that one out of four college students in America now have either received a diagnosis of a mental disorder or are on the psychotropic drugs for these disorders. That's 25%. That means that these colleges are now basically psychiatric clinics. So if you want to know why so many of these kids are acting very strange and talking about being triggered and needing safe spaces and all of that, you can trace that back to, again, the psychiatric incursion upon life in America and the prescription of these brain altering and brain scrambling drugs. These kids are all parading around with mental disorder diagnoses, which become sort of badges of honor. They all think that they're disabled. They all think that they have some sort of a lifetime problem with brain function that can only be remedied by taking these tremendously toxic drugs.
So let me speak in their defense for a second, because I live in a small rural community and I have my own well and a whole house filter. And I try to be very, very careful about what I eat. You know, I've been to your house and I'm not as perfect as your wife, but I'm pretty good. And then I take a lot of vitamins, and without those vitamins, I just couldn't get the nutrition I need. And I haven't owned a TV with the rare exception when I worked in the administration since 1984. I certainly don't have one in my house. I don't watch it. Now, if you look at the lifestyle of most of these kids, if I had to eat their diet, drink the water they're drinking, go without the vitamins they're going without, and watch the media that they watch, I don't know how I could remain. I don't know how I could function as a mature adult in society.
I agree. You're absolutely right. It's a combination of factors.
Right.
But when you do add in the psychiatric diagnosis and the drugs,
oh, it's
now,
it's.
You're now up.
I just can't imagine how they can function.
I don't either. I don't know. I really don't. Why any parent would want to send their kid to one of these colleges with all of the attendant dangers and problems is beyond me.
Well, I think they send them because there's also tremendous opportunity to learn and to meet people and to, you know, the challenges woven within these institutions, you also have a lot of good stuff. It's like the medical system, you know, it's full of dangers. It's also full of good stuff. And the question is, how do you navigate it and get the good stuff? Now, the reality with universities, increasingly, you can get it without going to the university.
Right.
But I think, you know, one of the things that the leadership wanted more than anything to do was to kill homeschooling. And not only have they not been able to kill it, but it's been flourishing, which is remarkable given how much time and commitment it takes on the part of parents. And I think part of it is because increasingly parents are just saying, you know, the whole thing is nuts. And I'm seeing that across the board, not just with educational institutions, but all institutions, you know, with parents saying, you know, the whole thing is just so nuts, I don't even want to, you know, I'm checking out completely. I give up trying to get the good. Let me bring up Manchurian candidates, because clearly another big part of this. So number one is the kids brought up without the, you know, the many things they need to become a functional adult, and you layer in the drugs, but then you layer in mind control. And if you look at the mind control these kids are being hit with video games or entrainment on the media and smartphones, it's incredible. Not to mention that there is such a thing as Manchurian candidate training. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about the different kinds of mind controls that may be operating in this situation.
Well, there are very suggestive things about James Holmes, for example, in the Aurora, Colorado, a theater shooting where they were premiering one of the Batman movies, because he had been a student of neuroscience, got his scholarship that way, seemed to begin to go off the rails, was seeing a Dr. Fenton in Colorado at the university where he was studying. She had been under some investigation and I think censure for prescribing drugs to herself, maybe her family, off the books. We don't know exactly what the drugs were that James Holmes was on, but clearly they would have influenced his state of mind. And it was a perfect kind of setup because it frightened the public so much. Young, brilliant student, looks kind of young, looks kind of like a techie, innocent looking, all of a sudden mass murderer. This was another case, by the way, in which two witnesses at least, said that there were other shooters in the theater. So whether Holmes was even involved or not, is a serious question. But who knows what may have been done to him in treatment, in other ways that we don't know about, in order to basically destroy his mind and
right.
set him up as somebody who was tuned up for destruction. That would be, you know, one suggestion, for example, in one of these.
Or tuned up to be an asset. I mean, there is
tuned
a history,
up to be an asset.
Right, of the national security state using kids, you know, put through mind control as assassins, as couriers, as sex slaves, as even data banks. So there's, you know, there is a long tradition of using children in covert operations, and it's a very profitable, successful angle. And the interesting thing about the school shootings, it was always kept very secret. But now, between Hollywood and the school shootings, you know, the technology is kind of coming out of the closet, and it's almost as though they're saying, you know, we can do this and do it in your face, and we can get you to pretend it's not really happening.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, just look at this as a sort of interesting sidelight. Somewhere in the southeast, I don't remember whether it's North Carolina, South Carolina, somewhere like that, there is a summer camp, talent camp for young kids. This is what people call talent spotting.
Right.
Young kids who have tremendous amount of intelligence and ability sometimes get scholarships, sometimes their parents pay, to send them to a talent camp for, quote, accelerated learning.
Right.
What's this all about? Well, one of these camps had Mark Zuckerberg and Lady Gaga when they were kids.
Right.
The same camp. Look at what they have wrought on the culture.
Right.
It's very easy to set these kids up, prime them, tune them up, and then a period of time elapses and magically they emerge into the public spotlight, heading up very important cultural operations.
Right. Right.
That's a serious form of mind control.
You know, one thing that the general population cannot fathom, John, because I've seen it and experienced and was part of it, the leadership spends a fortune on human resources, on identifying. I mean, they've got a file on you before you're born. It's almost like a breeding program. And they're cultivating and growing talent, moving it around and using it in phenomenal ways over very long periods of time. So they're working now to breed up the people who are going to lead in 20, 30, 40 years. And they spend a fortune on human resources, and they view humans as a resource, as a natural resource. And they're quite...
Let us not forget Skull and Bones, which
right.
is the older forms of human harvesting and enlistment, shall we say, at Yale, where... You know, something like 15, I think, seniors are tapped every year to become part of this extremely elite secret society. We could go back into the whole history in Germany and so forth. But these are basically people that are being primed and trained to take not just leadership roles in society, but controlling roles in society, criminal roles at the highest level.
Right.
So this has a very long history.
Right, and it's interesting. If you look at the third quarter wrap-up, we published Control 101, because I became so frustrated with, it was inspired by the Bitcoin community, who kept saying, oh, we're going to take this technology and throw over the structures of control. And no one seemed to understand that control ultimately is through physical force. And you can't shift control with a financial product when the people who control physically control the systems that the financial product operates on. So I finally said, okay, we got to step back and we got to look at control. We seem to be a little bit oblivious to how significant the control system is and how it really ultimately depends on physical force. If you look at the control system we had in this country as of 1947, when the national security state, you know, got turbocharged with the legal and financial money, what you did was you took the secret society network, then you brought in the paperclip Nazis, and then by combining it with the 47 and 49 acts, you integrated the funding of the intelligence agencies and you put them in charge of the financial system. And so you had secret societies plus intelligence agencies plus all the money on the planet, you know, and throw in the paperclip Nazis for fun. And it's been out of control. It's basically been growing and going out of control ever since then. And the reality is, if you look at how it manages the general population, false flags, and including school shootings, are one of its primary techniques.
Indeed. I mean, the school shootings, when you back up far enough and look at them, this is a way of saying to the public, life is very dangerous, and it's even dangerous for the children, especially dangerous. And we can prove it, because look at this shooting, look at that shooting, look at the shooting that just happened, and the aftermath of, in, say, Obama's case, claiming that he was going to start building community mental health centers all over America to stop these shootings, when in fact that was going to mean more psychiatry means more shootings. I just published a piece on that. So the shootings themselves are stage props to show the public this is the new reality here. They can't be stopped. Look at this one. Look at that one. Look at what happened here. Look at what happened there. And despite the many contradictions and questions that emerge in each case, they're shut down by the media. So a deep investigation into the truth really never occurs, at least getting all the way down to the bottom. And you've got the threat that any time at any school this could happen. I go back to Sandy Hook, because that was one of the prime examples of the media strategy. Okay, this is a big one, folks. It's happening in the heart of the Eastern establishment, where our people, you know, the liberal establishment lives, the wealthy liberal establishment, at one of these schools. We have to send out our prime national TV anchors to the scene to report, set up shop, wall-to-wall coverage, all day long, all night long, for as many days as we can stretch this out, to just keep priming the pump, keep emphasizing the incredible horror of the whole situation, etc., etc. That was the media strategy, and it still is, to a degree, case by case. They make their choice. Okay, who are we going to send out there? We're going to do this with local news anchors? We're going to send the big shots out there? How much time are we going to give to this? How much importance are we going to lay on it? Etc., etc. The media looks at these shootings as a media event. That is their point of view.
So let me say this. They look at it as an opportunity to make money.
Absolutely.
Right. So school shootings are good for business.
Just the way Trump is good for business. CNN, right. And Jeff Zucker has gone on the record, he's the head of CNN, saying we look at this at politics as theater.
Right.
Well, he was the guy that put Trump over the top on NBC on The Apprentice.
Right.
He made Trump, who is a celebrity, a super celebrity on NBC. And then at CNN, he went the other way and decided, well, what's good for business now is we attack Trump 24/7. Our ad rates go up. The eyeballs of the viewers, those numbers go up. And we make good money off of this. That's the way they're seeing this.
Right. So this is bread and circus. Instead of bringing people into the Coliseum and killing some Christians, you bring them into the media theater and you kill some kids.
Exactly. I mean, right. This is the raw truth, the basic truth of how the media handles all of this. They do it every time. They have no conscience. And that's their program.
So I want to bring up a few sort of stories. In the 90s, I was sitting talking with a friend who was much older than me and who had in her home TVs running all day long. And she had Comcast, was her service provider. And I was listening to her talk about her customer service demands with Comcast. And I sat there and realized I had a flash of intuition about the fundamental economics of her relationship with the telecoms. if you look at how much money they were spending to please her and do customer service and delight her, what I realized is, you know, this is not an economic relationship on putting the pipe in her home. Where they're making the money is delivering the entrainment and then harvesting her. And it all depends on her getting more and more attention. So as we're removing our political power and our political power is disappearing as we're entrained, we're getting more and more personal attention. And the technology is being delivered, like the grief counselors, to give us more and more attention and become more and more aware of ourselves and what we need and what we want, and making sure that the big corporation satisfies it. And what we don't understand is this attention we're getting from the big corporation is keeping us preoccupied while all of our political power walks out the door.
You bet.
And the economics work, not because we're paying them a subscription fee, but because literally they're entraining our minds to go along with things that allow them to steal and walk off with a federal credit. You know, whether it's stealing $21 trillion from HUD and DOD or bailing out the banks with $24 trillion. I mean, basically, this technology of putting a pipe in your home and then entraining you has allowed them to steal $50 trillion and engineer a financial coup d'etat. Without that mind control technology, it could never have happened.
Yeah, just imagine what would happen if television disappeared overnight. Along with the screams and the wails and the people committing suicide because they no longer had TV, you would have this giant void into which people would have to themselves introduce other activities in order to take up the time. And these would certainly be more productive in the long run, and you would no longer have the news, and all of the crime shows and cop shows, et cetera, all the programming that occurs on television.
In Las Vegas, we've seen a lot of the people who survived later die in very suspicious-looking accidents. And it looks to me what may be happening is, you know, the people who are dying started to make an effort to network with other survivors, of course, to figure out what really happened. Because it's the natural healing instinct. Let's figure out what really happened and see what we can do about it. And so you have a number of the survivors, I think it's up to 7, now dying mysteriously. And what you realize is, the efforts in society to keep us from talking to each other and figuring out what's really going on, whether it's assassinations or grief counselors, or piling on more media shriek-o-meter, is intense.
The Las Vegas shooting is a very shocking example. They locked down that whole city afterwards.
Right.
And I'm not just talking about the cops or the FBI. I'm talking about the media. Because, of course, Vegas depends entirely on tourism. So you had these videos. I mean, I'm sure some of the folks have seen them. I had a woman and her husband walking through the Bellagio, which was supposedly not even involved, with a cell phone camera and taking pictures of people massed in the lobby waiting for something. They said the casino was shut down. We can't go in there. Shots were fired through the front door. She says, I fell down on the floor. My husband jumped on top of me to shield me, et cetera, et cetera. There are many, 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 many reports of these witnesses.
Right.
Nothing in the media. Zero. The entire, quote, alternative news about what actually happened in that city was totally shut down. Amazing that they were able to pull this off, but they were, and they did, and there had to be significant collusion among the city fathers, among the casino owners, et cetera, big shots,
right.
Say,
right.
We have to control this scenario now. not tomorrow, not the next day, but now and forever, in order to keep the money train moving. Otherwise, we are going to see, and they did see, of course, a drop in tourism, but nothing like they would have seen if this story had broken wide open.
Although here's what was interesting about both Parkland and Las Vegas. Both events were so sloppy. When you look at this in terms of staging and organizing a covert operation, they're as sloppy as I've ever seen in my life. It's almost as though the whole process gets sloppier and sloppier. It's like the A-team has said, you know, we're getting out of here. This is getting too crazy. And the B-team is running things, and it's sloppy. Just from an engineering sense, it's sloppy. And I'm watching the sloppiness, and I'm thinking, you know, it's almost like internally they're breaking down somehow. They can't deliver the quality of and keep up the pace somehow. You know, I don't know what that means or where that goes, but to me, it's a very good sign. And I bring it up because on Friday, last Friday, my plane was landing. I flew back from the Netherlands. I'd been in Europe for 2 weeks. And I was approaching Philadelphia, so I landed in Philadelphia and then flew to Memphis. I was landing, and bam, our site goes down. So when I land, I call my team. And it turns out the damage is so horrendous that we decided we've been working on a new site. You know something? We're not going to fix the old site. We're just going to bring up the new site. And I thought, what in the world is going on that they are so afraid, you know, that this would happen at this time? So I sort of networked around. Well, Richie Allen, you know, they wiped out his YouTube channel. One of my subscribers said that 50% of his YouTube channels, he does a lot with Second Amendment, went down in the same hour that Soleri went down. And I'm guessing, but what it looks like to me is there is an enormous pushback, John, you know, trying to shut down the independent media because, first of all, the job was so sloppy, but second of all, the official reality is not working. It's not holding. If you look at the pushback on the... Now, obviously, they're using this to try and get gun control in a very major way. If you look at the pushback they're getting, what it says to me is the media operation of controlling the narrative is not working.
I agree. I think that's absolutely right. And I've been writing about this pretty much nonstop for the last year, that we are actually winning. And it's extremely important for people to understand that and to acknowledge it, as opposed to still staying in the old mindset, like, well, you know, how do you go up against the major news networks? No, it's actually happening before our eyes that people are defecting. We're talking about audience and viewers who were, let's say, on the fence and wondering whether they were getting the straight news. Well, they know they're not getting the straight news now. They absolutely know it. And so we're seeing increased desperation, which I think is perhaps one explanation for why some of these staged events are so sloppy, because there is an increased sense of panic and desperation in whatever you want to call it, the deep state, the establishment, certainly the media establishment, that they don't know what to do. They don't know how to combat the mass defection. So their basic strategy now has become censorship. This is the only thing they can think of. We have to destroy the outlets who are telling the truth or who are gaining more and more readers, subscribers, viewers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it's interesting. I always estimate, and I've said this many times, I estimate about $100,000 a year of my expenses are just dealing with these kinds of headwinds, of being hacked, of having this channel interfered with, of having your mail or your courier interfered with, and the just what it takes in terms of team time to deal with it. It's a massive expense, you know, and it's an expense, in essence, that our subscribers are funding and have to fund to get the truth. But the competition between independent media and, you know, and the official reality media is very, very intense and filled with, I don't know, lots of tensions. But what is amazing, if you look at the people providing the independent media, they never quit. It's amazing. It's, you know, I don't know if you saw Richie Allen's new website. He just came right back up and said, you know, it is what it is. I just had, I think he had, I don't know, 1,400 videos wiped out. So, yeah, it's, and I think he had 80,000 subscribers. So it was a major channel. Anyway, but the reality is, it's going to be, to me, it's going to be very healthy because independent media is going to stop using all those channels. In other words, if you're independent media and you're relying on Facebook or YouTube or Google or any of these folks, you know, you're asking to get the rug pulled out from under you. And so it's funny, I just talked to Jeff Rentz last night, and he had 2 weeks ago, he had PayPal pull his account, and then he went out and got an account with Stripe, and now they've pulled their account. So, you know, they play with the money too. Now, let me talk about the official narrative, because what we've seen in this society, and I keep coming back to the economics, is an unprecedented centralization of control of money. So control of taxpayers' money through the federal budget and control of local economies through the federal budget. 50% or more of every local county is controlled with directly or indirectly with federal money, federal purchases, federal contracts. So it's really become a Soviet economy through that. But control, I just wrote a big study on the pension funds, central control of family savings for the purpose of controlling investment. Now, here's the magic message that I really want to deliver today. You can't control the money centrally unless you can control the narrative centrally. In other words, if you lose control of the central narrative, you can lose control of central control of the money. And so I think right now they're desperate to control the narrative, because otherwise you had the mayor of San Leandro, or the former mayor, stand up and say, letting CalPERS manage our pension fund money is allowing the wolf to guard the hen house. We need to get out of the system. Okay? That's a very capable, intelligent person saying, we're being, you know, our money's being drained and we're being played and we've got to get financial independence from the system. You know, let's come out. And whether it's coming out of the banks or coming out of the pension funds or, you know, dealing with the disappearing money from the federal government, once you get the really educated, experienced, intelligent people saying, you know something, we can do this ourselves, and coming out of the central control, if the central narrative breaks down, then the central control of the money breaks down, John.
That's a great, fabulous point. I agree. And it's been happening. Again, the central narrative has been breaking down. If you haven't watched network news, major, you know, the major broadcast at night for a long time, just, you know, grind your teeth. And if you've got a television set, put it on and watch it for one night and see what they're doing. See what they're doing right on CNN, see what they're doing on NBC. This is the junior varsity, the B team, the freshman, the junior high school. It's many levels below the quality of mind control that used to exist.
Right.
These people are completely incompetent. They have no charisma. They have no real training in how to entrain minds. This is not Walter Cronkite anymore. This is not even Brian Williams anymore. This is people who are either living cadavers giving you the news, or young, fresh kind of college faces that have no authority behind them whatsoever. And the content of what they're talking about, you'll see when you watch it, you'll say, my God, it's they're talking about nothing. they're absolutely talking about nothing. This story, the president says, and then the White House, and the, and here's a story about something, rain here. They've got nothing. It's worse than you can possibly imagine if you haven't watched it for a while. So they're falling apart.
Right.
They really don't know what to do. They don't even have a central narrative anymore.
Right.
They wouldn't know what it was if it just rose up and bit them on the end of their nose.
Well, it's funny. I don't know if you've been watching what Mueller is doing, but you know, essentially, he's going after Paul Manafort on stuff that happened way before the campaign. Then he's going after a Russian social media effort. And if you dig into the indictment, it's so, you know, he's bringing it because he knows he'll never have to put evidence in a court of law. Somebody, one of the Wall Street Journal editorial writers said that these guys had, you know, less impact on the campaign than Donald Trump for 30 seconds during one of his rallies. And, you know, he's desperate to make it look like there was Russian interference, and he has nothing. So he's just squeezing Manafort with old stuff, and then he's putting up something, you know, that he can put in a legal document because he's never going to have to produce evidence, and they're there. And if you look at it, it's so Mickey Mouse, you don't even know what to say. It's embarrassing being an American in Europe and having to explain that adults would do something like this, because it's so childish. It's so debasing of our brand on the international stage. And it's
the article that you sent me yesterday, which was a whopper, was basically an attempt to accuse a Russian news outlet, I think it was Sputnik, of, quote, intentionally running anti-GMO articles to try to make destructive consequences on America because, you know, American giant corporations with GMO food and so much GMO crop in America and so forth, as if these stories questioning and criticizing GMOs and pesticides that were running on Sputnik, this was really, you see, a Russian attempt, a propaganda attempt to debase really good science and good agriculture in America and destroy people's faith in the food that they're eating in America. I mean, the logic was so skewed and so bizarre and so weird in this whole thing that, again, it was like, where did you get these guys from? I mean, is this all you've got?
Well, here's what it looks like to me. You know, you've got a group of people, their official narrative isn't working, but instead of trying to evolve the official narrative to something that they can find that will work, they're just continually double down. And so what you're doing is you're doubling down on the lies, you're doubling down on the secrecy, and truth is a volcanic force. When you double down in this way, you know, you put pressure on something that's you know, ready to explode in the opposite direction. And so it's a very, to me, it's a very explosive situation, because I think they're planning on rolling 5G out. And part of our problem, John, I always said that people who manage in a rig game get stupid. Your ability to rig makes you stupid. And I think the mind control has been far more successful than they ever dreamed. And they've gotten so dependent on it that they don't know what to do other than double down on the lies and hope that the 5G mind control really pulls them out.
Well, that's pretty much the way it looks to me. I've been saying for a long time, major media have no answers anymore. They don't know how financially to survive. They don't know how to present a narrative. They don't know what to do in the face of rising independent media. And the school shootings are really, when you look at a number of them, they're a very good example, because the actual after effect, as far as the information is concerned, is to get many, 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 many more people to question the official story. That's right. What happens, because people put up videos, they put up stories, they question this, they question that. What about this witness testimony that nobody's paying any attention to? And so the effect, the rebound effect, is just the opposite of what was intended. And this is happening over and over again.
We're coming into the 2018 elections in November, and of course we have primaries during the summer. You know, and all sorts of campaign things starting from this spring into November 2018. And in the heartland, people are not going to stand for gun control. They're not going to stand for it. So I live in Tennessee, and one of the reasons I live in Tennessee, I'm a member of the Tennessee Firearms Association, and our membership is more than 50% of the regularly voting population. Mm-hmm. So, and we're not going to tolerate it. It was very interesting. Last week you had the governor of Kentucky, and it was funny because we had just posted this right before the site went down. The governor of Kentucky did an interview, I think, on Fox News and said, you know, when I was a kid, we had more guns than we have now, but we didn't have these school shootings. What's changed? It's not the guns. What's changed is we have video games and movies that are excessively violent, and we invite our children to digest a huge amount of violence. And frankly, if you look at the money networks behind the school shootings, pushing back, in fact, at the people who I think, you know, are much more responsible in terms of investment community. And you would never have seen that 5 years ago, John. You would never have seen the governor of Kentucky standing up and saying this gun control thing is hooey. And I think one of the reasons is, if you look at the politicians who have to run for election in places like Tennessee and Kentucky, you know, they're not going to fall for all the tricks. They're going to stand up in the face of the barrage. And we've seen plenty of people in Congress stand up in the face of the barrage, even after they get shot. Yeah. So it's going to make the 2018 campaign very interesting, especially, you know, the latest news is that Trump has folded on some of the gun control issues. Now, let me ask you this. Speaking of controlling the money centrally, why do you think there is such a push to bring in the guns?
Well, you know, it's the usual story. We've got to take away the guns because we want a completely disarmed population. I mean, Switzerland is not a perfect country, but when was the last time you heard about mass school shootings in Switzerland? Everybody's right. Got a gun. Everybody's got multiple guns. So this becomes a key issue. If we can get people to fold on guns, I mean, aside from just, you know, what guns really do for people, which is allow them the right of self-defense, if we can get people to fold on this issue of gun control and permit it step by step by step, then we create a psychological state of mind in the public where they say, okay, we give up. The police, the army, they have all the guns. Of course, the criminals do too, but we'll try to ignore that. And that's our society of the future. We accept that. We accept that we want a society in which law enforcement has the guns and we don't. Now, the psychological effect of that is absolutely enormous. Whether or not you have a gun, whether or not you own a gun, whether or not you even know how to shoot a gun, it's an enormous incursion on people's state of mind if they say, okay, we give up. We absolutely give up. We don't care where most of the gun crimes are occurring in America. We don't even want to know. We will treat the rancher out in the Southwest who's got 15 guns and never shot anybody on the same level that we will treat gang members in some inner city who are doing drive-bys. It's all the same. We give up. We surrender. Whatever you guys want, go ahead, finally do it. And that's the future. that to me is one of the, you know, back end features, let's say, of the whole gun issue and where it's really attempting to go.
Right. I think it's about money. In other words, you've got, so let me describe the numbers on the pension funds. We have $21 trillion missing from HUD and DOD. We have $24-plus trillion that was lent or given to the banks during the bailouts. And if you add up some of the other frauds, you easily get to $50 trillion. Now, the underfunding on the pension funds right now is approximately $5 trillion. You can take it lower or higher depending on your assumptions, which is only 10% of what we've stolen or given away with no legal obligation to do it. And the question is, are we going to fund that $5 trillion, or are we just going to turn to everybody and say, well, you know, there's no money, and don't look at how your money's been managed and whether there was a deep state drain or not. You know, you didn't save enough. It's your fault. Goodbye. Now, it's a lot easier to do that if nobody has any guns.
Sure. That's an excellent point. I agree. You bet. It's a lot right. easier to do that if, you know, Samson has no hair anymore.
Right.
Sure.
Right, and it's really interesting. I mean,
on this, many vectors as to what, you know, what about the guns?
Right.
I mean, school shootings themselves, you know, if you've got schools under the gun, literally and figuratively, then people are going to start thinking, well, we need some kind of armed protection, wherever it's going to come from. Oh, but wait a minute, we can't do that because these are A, gun-free zones, and plus, we've now taken all the guns away from everybody, so nobody has any guns, so I guess we just can't do that anymore. Well, how is that going to play? I don't think very well.
Right. If you look at the real deal on school shootings, the moral of the story is we need to take the guns, you know, away from the FBI, the CIA, and tell the Mossad to get the hell out of the country.
Yeah, that'd be a nice first step, sure.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about my personal experience, because in 2014, I dealt with somebody trying to sort of run a frame on me. And it's one of the reasons I avoid doing business in California anymore. And my guess as to who was involved was literally a reality TV show, or, you know, a production studio that does reality TV. And it was like they're trying to create fake news. And obviously there was multiple purposes to it. One of it was to destroy or to harm my credibility. But you really saw this staging. And if you look at the people involved on the other side, they were eager and happy to do it. They had no concept that this was wrong or that inventing and creating fake news was wrong. They just, you know, this was like a sport. It's like a survival sport. I don't know how to describe it, but literally a psychopathic culture. And I used to see it when I was in Washington, because you'd send these SWAT teams up to drop into poor neighborhoods, round up kids. And it was like they were going hunting. And they were totally indifferent to what the real law was. They were going to go hunting, round up some kids and put them into prison and get a bonus. And, you know, it was like they... I just finished watching Craig Atkinson's new documentary of watching SWAT teams go in and do drug busts. And it's like they've got this fantasy in their head, and they drop into a neighborhood and they play out the fantasy, even though the fantasy has no bearing on reality. And you have these folks who are sitting up, you know, who are getting rounded, their home is being harmed, their kids are being arrested, and they're having to play the other side of the fantasy when the fantasy is not true. You know, and they're looking at it and coming at it from a viewpoint of reality and saying, you know, you people are nuts, not to mention the harm you're doing to us. But there's this, right, this psychopathic culture that is running around and manufacturing reality one situation at a time, you know, and they have these fantasies programmed into their heads. And it's pretty scary to watch if you've ever seen it. And I suspect that more and more Americans are going to be exposed to it as these teams keep landing with instructions to manufacture reality.
I can testify to a bit of what you're talking about through emails now and then. Okay, I see, you know, sort of critical comments coming my way, built up to an absurd proportion. I mean, I'm not going to go into details because I don't want to give these folks any credit, you know, about who I am, what I am, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I look at these and I delete them and so forth. And then I start thinking, so what kind of people are we dealing with here? They have no life. They have nothing. They create nothing. They make nothing better. So the only thing they have left is exactly what you called it, which is a sport.
Right.
Let's do this sport, which is trying to defame somebody that we pick out. And we'll say anything. Doesn't matter what we do. We have no knowledge, real knowledge or understanding of what it takes for that person to build what he or she has built, or why they're building it, or what they're doing, for what purpose. We know nothing about that. Our knowledge of that, let's call it history of America and what it means to actually build something by an individual, the vision it takes, the creative capacity it takes, the effort, the time, the commitment, et cetera, all of those things, the self-reliance, we don't understand that. We don't even know what that means. That's lost. We have no memory of that. It makes no sense to us to even hear about it or read about it because we have nothing inside us that we can connect with it. So therefore, it doesn't matter what we say about this particular individual, because to us, he or she is just a sort of symbol, unit, machine, whatever. Doesn't really matter. That is a rapidly emerging culture. That is happening on small and large levels. Do you think that YouTube, for example, ever stops to consider when they decide to delete 1,500 videos or they want to shut down somebody's YouTube channel, who that person is, what it took for that person to do what they have been doing, why they're doing it, the principles upon which that person stands, the time, the effort, the commitment, the vision, the honest intent, all of those things which used to be understood and even celebrated in the culture. I frequently bring up this point. The Republic, if you look at the documents, the founding documents, the American Republic, was really founded on the idea of course, individual freedom, unshackling the individual from centralized power, which was the tradition in Europe, to be free, to be able to create their own futures. Well, if that's to happen, there's a presupposition that such individuals have the power to do that. Individual power is at the heart of what these documents were all about, imperfect
right.
as they may have been. Okay, therefore, you would expect that if you were to examine every single college and university in America, that somewhere still there would be a course taught called individual power. Well, in fact, if any college or university in America dared to try that, they would be destroyed overnight.
Right.
Absolutely destroyed overnight. That's what's happened to the culture. That's how these people who are nothing but destroyers.
It's like the nothing and the never-ending story. So you and I did a Solaria report in, I think it was 2013 or 2014. I'll go find a link and put it up in the subscriber links. And it was on your set of interviews, which I love and we'll talk about when we close. And it was remarkable because I knew there was going to be interference. And I set up three telephones. And during the interview, which you didn't realize, I was having to move from phone to phone to phone because literally not only did the phones go out and get disconnected, but even the power in my hotel room went down. But I was able to keep it going because I had three phones connected in and I had three independent, you know, independent, and I also had independent power sources. So, but it was amazing.
Wow.
Because I kept saying, this is really good because, you know,
getting cut off so many times.
Right. But one of my favorite testimonials on the Soleri Report ever came back, because what we were talking about was, and what your interviews are brilliant at, is describing how reality is manufactured. And one of my subscribers wrote in and she said, all my life I've been to these New Age seminars where they explain how I can invent my own reality. And they've never worked and they've never resonated. But I listened to John Rappaport explain to me how my reality is manufactured for me. And for the first time in my life, I realized, oh, I can create my own reality. Because if I can understand how they're manufacturing my reality for me, then I can understand how I can do it too.
Well, you've just described the whole basis of my work for the last 35 years. That's what I've been doing. That's the whole point. If I show you how reality is falsely built, how the court painters are putting up the paintings and the murals and the frescoes, and then the promoters are telling you to look at these and nothing else, and that this is reality. If somebody comes along, and that was my self-appointed task, and says, okay, we're going to look close up now at the paintings.
Right.
And see how they're built, how they're put together. As you say, the nuts and the bolts. And then you will see exactly how reality is manufactured for you. Then you're going to get the crossover insight. You're going to say, wow, if they can do that, then I can do it myself for me.
Now, the hardest thing for someone listening to your work when they come in, you know, and they haven't had the advantage of reading everything for the last 35 years or listening to everything for the last 35 years, it is very difficult for many people to fathom that things are as manufactured and controlled as they are. So this usually happens to me with people who are in psychotherapy or psychology. They can't fathom that their industry is really as bad as it is because they came into it with a good intention. They know lots of other people with a good intention and they're trying very hard to do good things in the system and they can't fathom it's as bad as it is. You know, and it's very threatening. So very occasionally, and don't be offended by what I'm going to say, I'll have somebody write in and say, I'm unsubscribing to the Soleri Report because I can't stand John Rappaport.
Take that as a high compliment.
I know, I do. And I realize, oh, they'll be back.
Yeah,
but
they
it's
will be
too,
back.
It's too scary. It's too overwhelming to sit down and face it. Now, one of the reasons I really encourage people to go read, there's so much great stuff, but Secret of Secret Society and your interviews, because what your interviews do, you give permission to an insider to unpack how the nuts and bolts of control works in all these different areas, from the Vatican to advertising to health control, and you go through it, and John, they are flawless. It used to amaze me when I read them. There was not one fact, not one intuition or insight. There was nothing that was ever contradictory of anything I've ever dealt with in reality, whether personal experience or the money. I mean, they're just flawless. And so you really got these people to tell all. I don't know how you did it, but you explore at a very intimate level, and I think that's where these things break down. It's easy to read a book and say you read a great, like Richard Dolan's great new series on false flags. You watch that and you understand false flags. It's another thing to get down and understand at an intimate level how you might interact with it in healthcare or at the church or whatever, and that you really bring it down to an intimate level. So just talk a little bit about the interviews and how we access them.
Okay, well, all these interviews that you're mentioning are included in a collection of mine called The Matrix Revealed. There are three of these Matrix collections, and people can go to my website at nomorefakenews.com, and they can click on the banners, and they can read a description of the contents of each collection. So this one is The Matrix Revealed, and it does contain many pages of interviews with these insiders. For example, a retired propaganda operative at a very high level, who decided finally that he had to get out of the game because he began to become human, which was a severe shock to his system. But eventually, through a series of preliminary conversations years ago, he decided that he would be willing to engage in, you know, interviews with me. And as we kept on talking, he kept on revealing. And to say that he found it therapeutic, I think, was a vast understatement. He really wanted to get the information out there. So that's where people can find the interviews. And I found them to be galvanizing to me, myself, to say the least, because I had these intimations myself from working as a reporter and interacting here and there with mainstream reporters and information sources and government scientists and all sorts of people, where I began to see, you know, there is a nuts and bolts here. There's something, as you say, more intimate, where we can see how these people consciously and unconsciously are putting together and inventing reality for us on a whole scale. And that's what these interviews are.
You know, I grew up in a world where we invented our reality. We invented the whole world's reality. We were free to do that. We understood how you did it. You know, I never knew it was called a conspiracy. You just got together, you made a plan, and you went off and you did it. And it was a series of transactions or events. And that's how you created and built your world. And it was great. It was a great thing to do. It was a great thing to be good at. And, you know, so I come out of a world where, hey, you want to do it, just invent it. You can invent anything. To a world where you're not allowed to invent, and it is threatening to suggest that you can. And it's such a switch for me to come out of that world where I'm powerful, I can invent whatever I want, to a world where, you know, we're not allowed to invent, stop it. And I can't fathom, well, what's the problem? Let's just invent, you know, we don't like what they're inventing. Let's just invent our own thing. And so talk a little bit, because part of your work is, of course, unpacking reality. And nobody, I have to tell you, John, nobody does it better than you. But the other half of your work is really on that. Okay, well, let's invent our own reality. How do we do that? And so a lot of it is on imagination, creativity, and finding your own way to have what I call the free and inspired life, despite, you know, what the other team is doing.
Indeed. Okay, so that is the second collection called Excerpts from the Matrix. And again, people can go to nomorefakenews.com and they can read about that. And among many other facets of that collection, there are dozens of imagination exercises which I developed over the years, and I describe how to do them and how to use them and what they're for and the background and so forth. Because doing them on a daily basis taps into one's own creative power. And eventually, with commitment, there is a kind of transference factor that occurs where a person begins to say, well, gee, I do have this capability of imagination in many, many different ways over a wide range and scope, and I can feel the feedback from doing these exercises, which is certainly welcome and beneficial. And so now, why don't I begin to consider and decide and create my vision of what it is, what reality it is that I want to invent. That's the transfer factor. Because now emboldened and made more confident by being able to deploy your own imagination in many different ways through these exercises, that is the natural outcome. Okay, well, all right. I've now thrown off a lot of useless stuff from the culture here, and I've gotten back to my own core. So I can do this. So the question now becomes, all right, what is my vision of what it is that I, the reality that I want to invent? And many people, of course, will have different outcomes for that. That's the way it's supposed to be, because every individual is unique. So that is what that is about.
So here's why we need this work. Because the message of the Parkland school shooting or Las Vegas is the central narrative is breaking down and they don't know what to do. And so we're going to have to figure out what to do. But that's going to come down to each person and each family figuring out what their piece is. You know, it's very unique once you get into an individual situation. And so we're going to have to reinvent the narrative because the leadership can't. They just don't have the capacity and they're too stuck in the old story. So I'm reminded, you know, my favorite speech was your Mark Twain speech in Mexico, but one of my favorite speeches was your speech in 2014 at the Secret Space Program. It's up on the internet so people can watch it, but it's about this idea of reinventing the narrative. And you start off with a quote that I use all the time. You would be embarrassed if you knew how much I quote you, which flashed up on the big screen and it says, "Hopelessness is an op and it's planet wide." Tell us about, because that's the one thing you've got to do. The one thing you've got to do is you've got to leave hopelessness behind permanently. And let me tell you, they do everything they can. The school shootings are part of it to persuade you it's hopeless. And it's not. You know, they're geniuses at marketing hopelessness. So maybe if you could say a little bit about how to permanently leave hopelessness behind.
Okay. Well, hopelessness is an artifact. It's an invention, really. You can bring up those feelings in people as a propagandist, if you're good, but that doesn't mitigate the fact that it is a kind of an art form or an artifact. It's an invention, hopelessness. It's not something that we say, well, this is really the lesson from all of our history that everything is hopeless and so on. It's an invention, like many other inventions. Okay, so somebody invented the steam engine, and somebody invented the wheel, and somebody invented fire, and somebody invented the computer. Well, somebody invented hopelessness as a tactic.
Right.
Leadership. My form of leadership is to inculcate as many people as possible with the idea of hopelessness, which I will then, use in my effort to maintain my position and say, there is hope. It's my kind of hope. Because, of course, that's the follow-up. If you become dependent upon me, then I will lead you out of the labyrinth. So people have to understand that whatever shreds and threads of this artifact called hopelessness that still exist within them, that is a sort of a hangover. That's the hangover from very artful and very long-term propaganda. It's not them. This is not you. This is not what you are. This is not what you want to be. And therefore, you don't have to bow down to it. It's not a god. It's not a god.
Right.
And people, I'll say one more thing about it. Hopelessness becomes a habit. In other words, once you embrace it, then you find, as humans will, what you can do with it.
Right.
Well, I can use this, you see, because then I can rationalize a whole host of things that I'm not doing, that I'm not thinking about, that I'm not planning, that I'm not creating. Yes, this works. I can deploy this to explain my own passivity, because I'm just a kind of a cog in the great machine of hopelessness, and so, and people will become artists of hopelessness. They will embroider up one side and down the other the whole concept, and they will use it to their own benefit, in heavy quotes.
Right.
But it's negative benefit. It's on the negative side of the ledger all the time. And so if people can get an inkling of this, they can now work with a kind of a lever to just offload that hopelessness as a tool they don't want to use anymore, and then say, well, if I get rid of that, then where do I go? What do I do? Well, what you do is you begin to form a vision of what it is that you do want to create, what reality you do want to create, because things are not hopeless anymore.
So one last thing, I want to come back and close on school shootings, because the question for teachers and parents now is, what do they do? And one of the things I want teachers and parents to do is to start to look at the money, because there is a relationship between what is happening with these security issues and shootings and what's going on in the money, particularly teachers' pension funds and school budgets. School budgets are a very important part of any county budget, and you know the private guys are moving in and want to take control. So now's the time, if you're a teacher or parent, to pay attention to what's going on in the money and make sure that this is not, you know, the way you're going to get power on these policies is to control the money and to make sure the money's being run clean and that there's no covert operations going on. I don't even want to bring up what's happening with pedophilia in some school districts. So I would say to the teachers and the parents, you know, now's a good time to start taking responsibility to understand what's really going on in the governance and the financial structure of the educational establishments you're using. What would you say, John?
Well, I think that's a brilliant idea, and it's absolutely essential. You know, if you had a spreadsheet in front of you of your school system's budget, which is supposedly public, what's the picture? Where's the money coming from? Where is it going? What are the programs? How much money is going here? How much money is going there? And why? You begin to now take control with knowledge and say, my God, so this is the system that we're really working with?
Right. So here's the question. Your property taxes are funding, or your tuition money is funding, teaching your kids. Is your tuition money and property taxes funding teaching your kids to be the most excellent human beings they can be and the most successful human beings they could be? Or is it teaching them to be cannon fodder for you know, the establishment's wishes to keep them down and keep them controlled and use them as labor input for whatever their plans are?
Yeah, I mean, look at kids coming out of college with, let's call it, a non-technical education. Whatever, you know, there's so many departments that would be considered non-technical where you can't just parlay what you've learned into a job. All of a sudden, after 12, 16 years of education, here's a young person floundering, trying to figure out, what do I do to make a living?
Right.
And it's an unworkable fit. Well, if that's
right.
The outcome of the system, why
Something's
did
wrong.
You invest so much in it to begin with?
Right.
Why didn't you think of other alternatives?
Well, teachers and parents are investing, and kids are investing a tremendous amount of time and money. And I know if they were unleashed and free to do what they wanted, we would get a much better result. But you can't get that result until they sit down and say, you know something, this really is as bad as it is, and we're going to assert adult supervision.
And that is certainly the right of communities of parents to do that. That's
right.
What communities are supposed to be doing. They're not supposed to be just surrendering and throwing up their hands and saying, we don't understand what's going on, but it's the only game in town. It's not the only game in town.
One thing I'll make a plea for, John, because it's my, you know, I always, whenever I talk about these subjects, I think, what's my deepest, darkest fear? And last year, and when we did Control 101, I make it as mandatory as possible for subscribers to watch a dreadful movie called The Kingsman about the technology, the mind control technology that really can get, you know, a group of people to stand up and kill each other. And my fear about whatever happens, whether teachers arm themselves with guns or not, you know, we all need to know that this kind of technology exists, because we can't just protect ourselves from somebody having a gun. We need to protect ourselves from somebody delivering invasive and invisible surveillance and mind control in a way that manipulates our emotions and can, you know, if you look at the Kingsman technology, can manipulate not just one mind-controlled shooter, but a whole crowd.
Indeed. Indeed.
Right.
I mean, you start to look at a subject like education, you've got to go all the way with it. You've got to figure
right.
out what is really going on at every level here. And there are so many different levels. And the more you know as a parent, teacher, student, the more you see, okay, here is yet another place where reality is being created for us. Why do we want that? Why don't we want to create the reality that we want for our children? Why don't we decide what education really should be like?
Okay, but to do that, we have to be free to have an open conversation and bring up these technologies, which many people are not aware of. And I think that's what, if you look at why we're getting this incredible turning up of the shriek-o-meter, I think it's because people are starting to have honest conversations and talk about these things. And that's what is the threat, the honest conversation whereby teachers, students, and parents talk about, okay, how do we turn this around? And, you know, because the honest conversation is what blows the control. So if you're out there struggling with this, if you're a teacher, if you're a student, if you're a parent, the question for you is, how can you create a safe process to have an honest conversation in your community? Because that's what it's going to take.
Yes. You have to be aware of the incursions, let's say, against having that conversation and be watchful as to where they're coming from and what they are. Because people,
right.
you know, who are in control want to stay in control. I mean, it's that simple. They don't want to give it up. It doesn't matter how degraded and debased the form of control is. That's what they're all about. So they're going to try to make an incursion against having that honest conversation, or many honest conversations.
Okay, so before we close, John, last thing. In addition to writing about Las Vegas and the school shootings, tell us right now what you're working on.
Well, let's see. Let me just pull it up here. What am I working on? Well, I have written a couple of recent articles about the psychiatric drugs, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm writing a piece titled Oprah Waiting for God to Tell Her Whether to Run for the Presidency.
Oh, God.
And the more that I work on this piece, the more interesting it becomes, because that's quite a presumption, not only to hold to oneself, but to broadcast publicly.
Right.
I mean, this is now out there. Oprah is waiting for God to tell her whether to run for the presidency. What does that really mean?
Okay, so here's, Oprah to me is a very fascinating topic right now, because Oprah, while the Clinton and then the Bush administration were dropping SWAT teams and rounding up innocent kids, putting them in private prisons where they made money making uniforms for the Department of Defense at probably a penny an hour, you know, essentially, we engineered a slave labor system using mostly poor black kids. And while it was going on, Oprah sat there and entertained everyone, white and black, saying, things are fine, go shopping, things are fine, go shopping, things are fine, go shopping, join my book club. And it worked. I mean, she did an incredible job of entertaining everybody into believing things were fine, while, you know, something that rivaled the Nazi slave labor operation was going on with black kids. You know, and that's how she became a billionaire. She became a billionaire providing air cover for the greatest genocide operation on black people since the slave trade.
Quite a remarkable figure. And also, you start to look at how she has entertained people and convinced them that everything is fine. You know, Right. Again, it's the nuts and the bolts and the details of the thousands of programs and interviews that she's done and so on and so forth. The bending and the twisting of ideas and information to create the reality that she created, you know, and to pass it on.
Well, I would say she was the best manufacturer of an official reality that we've seen in our generation. Wouldn't you say that?
Quite amazing. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So she is the best generator of fake reality, you know, on the stage today. And, you know, the idea that you could, here's the thing. It's one thing to create a fake reality in a media role. Trying to do it when you run the federal budget, it's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah. It's
you can't fake reality when you're cutting somebody's entire income.
No. But she has really parlayed this every step of the way. And it's quite instructive. Quite instructive.
Yes.
Look at the ideas, the people that she's brought in, the messages. She has, you know, invented her own universe and sold it over and over and over again. And now it's waiting for God to tell her whether to run.
Well, if she does run, if God does tell her to run, it's because God wants the destruction of Oprah Winfrey to be, you know, to be the way that we finally come to terms with the manufactured reality.
So be it.
So exactly. So be it. Okay, John, this has been a pleasure talking with you today. Anything you want to mention before we close?
No, I think it's just great to be here with you as always. We've been doing this for years now, and I love it every time. And it's just some of the great conversations that we have, and hope to see you soon.
Oh, I hope to see you soon. Thank you, John Rappaport. Thank you for joining us on the Salieri Report.
Thank you, Catherine.